under advisement. Have a good day. And we next have the proceeding, Denise Marie Keenholz, Douglas Floyd Keenholz. The file number is A181383.
Of course I did.
And I'll note, it's nice to see familiar faces who've familiar with my service out in the 8th Judicial District and for some time. As counsel is aware, you have 15 minutes, the appellant, 15 minutes for respondent, 5 minutes to respond if you wish. When you approach the podium, we'll ask you to identify yourself for the record. And when appellant's ready to proceed, you may.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Casey Swanson from Anderson Larson Law Firm in Wilmer, appearing on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Keenholz. Before we get into the merits of the case, I just think it's helpful to have a little bit of a background. This is a fairly long marriage between Mr. Keenholz and Ms. Keenholz. The relevant facts as the appellant sees them in this matter is Mr. Keenholz's acquisition of a significant amount of an inheritance, close to $380,000 following the death of his father. Subsequently, and I believe this is adequately traced within the documents that are provided, $311,000 somewhat of that inheritance was used to purchase a home.
I'm going to interrupt you, Mr. Swanson, only to kind of jump past that, because part of what I'm going to ask you, I'm assuming it may not be relevant. Of course, respondent would argue not relevant at all at this stage in terms of the facts, but could you point to the court, particularly based on at least the facts as we see them in the two briefs, but what basis this court under a fraud standard would have to reverse the trial court under the 518, I believe it's 145 standard?
Thank you, Your Honor. And the appellant would agree and noted this within the brief that it's an abuse of discretion standard, most typically applied to a case like this. Most importantly, I believe it was Judge Anderson in his order denying the appellant's motion, he found that, I believe his exact language was, the decree made no representation as to ownership. I'm not sure how there could have been no representation as to the ownership of the house if it was a default hearing. There was definitely no finding that it was non-marital property because that was never disclosed, neither in the petition, on the record, in the decree order. So I think that's clearly erroneous finding that there was no representation about the marital or non-marital character of the homestead. Obviously, there was.
What did you say? Obviously, there was?
Right. There was, I would say, it says.
I'm looking at the petition for marriage dissolution in paragraph 14. And the petitioner alleged that the petitioner and respondent hereto are the owners of or have an interest in their homestead. And then the address is given. How is that statement in any way a misrepresentation of facts?
It's a answer. I'm just going to interrupt. I noticed the time hasn't been running. I'm guessing we're down to about 13 or so.
Okay, thank you. It's running now.
Very good. Thank you. Sorry.
Thank you.
And Your Honor, could
so
you...
How is that a misrepresentation in any way? The allegation contained in paragraph 14 of the marriage dissolution petition.
The misrepresentation is that it doesn't represent Mr. Keenholz's non-marital interest.
Well, maybe there was no non-marital interest. This isn't a case like some of the cases where a person came into a marriage already owning property. And so it was clear that the property was acquired before marriage. This is property that was acquired during the marriage, and under the law, there's a presumption that it's marital property.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I would just cite to even the respondent's brief. The respondent acknowledges funds used for the purchase included appellant's inheritance funds.
Well,
so,
but it's his burden to prove that.
And I think he did. The record, which was submitted during the motion hearing, provided the check that immediately followed his receipt of the $380,000.
Okay, but that's all after the fact. Where is the misrepresent? You're saying that what you're arguing to us is that the petitioner had a duty to specifically set forth in the petition how the party's homestead was acquired and with what funds. And I can tell you that in over 30 years as a lawyer, I have never seen that in a petition. But that's what you're arguing should have happened here.
I think that's exactly what happened in the case that was just recently before the Court of Appeals in the Bjorg versus Moss. It was an unpublished case, but it was the exact same situation where there was no representation of the other party's non-marital interests.
But that was acquired before the marriage, was it not?
I'm not sure.
It was. I just read the case last night.
But I think the upshot from my perspective is that it's still a non-marital interest that wasn't disclosed.
Okay, it's an unpublished opinion. Do you have any other case law that would suggest that a petitioner has a duty to point out in a petition for marriage dissolution what the other side might claim to constitute non-marital property?
Thank you, Your Honor. I would cite to the Doring case in which there's the affirmative duty to disclose all assets and liabilities, a full and fair disclosure of all these assets and liabilities.
Okay, and I'm just going to stop you right there because in Doring, the party who, I think that's the party that had the $1 million pension. Am I right?
That sounds correct, Your Honor.
And the parties got together, and correct me if I'm wrong, they got together with a family attorney?
That sounds correct.
A member, a family friend who was an attorney who met with both of them. There was never any discovery. And I believe it was the wife who was the nurse who had the $1 million valuable pension, and she agreed to give her husband, what was it, a couple hundred thousand or 180,000 of her pension, and he was entirely clueless about the value of her pension. Aren't the facts in that case really different than the facts in our case, where we're talking about property that both parties lived in as their homestead? Your client claims that he purchased it with an inheritance. Wouldn't he be in a fine position to know all the facts surrounding the property, unlike the husband in Doring?
And I think that kind of blends into the issue a little bit of the excusable neglect and the kind of unusual status of how this default hearing proceeded. This wasn't a contested dissolution, full-blown hearing where there was discovery exchange.
And why wasn't it?
Mr. Keenholz was in jail and subsequently in prison.
But he was served with this petition before he was in jail.
Correct.
And did nothing.
He did not file.
Put his head in the sand, apparently.
He did ask to appear at the default hearing, was not permitted to physically appear at that hearing, which was noted in the record.
Well, no, because he was in jail, and it's a civil matter.
Correct.
But didn't, I read something in the record last night that indicated that Judge Anderson said that he would give your client an opportunity to participate by telephone from jail.
Thank you, Your Honor. That was the default hearing, not Judge Anderson. That was Judge Benson,
I believe.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay.
And I believe he gave that option to the respondent. He raised the issue. Mr. Keenholz requested to be here. He was committed to the Commissioner of Corrections, so he literally cannot be here. Would you like to make arrangements for him to see if he can appear by phone? And the respondent said, no, I want to proceed with the hearing today. No arrangements were ever made. They pushed through with the default hearing.
Okay.
So I think especially in light of the fact that we have to consider this is a pro se individual with no formal legal knowledge. Within the default motion hearing, the respondent makes reference to her belief that Mr. Keenholz has brain damage from alcoholism. So I think we have to factor all of that in. We're considering a significant piece of property here.
Mr. Swanson, you seem to suggest in answer to the judge's questions that there's no distinction between here where and a purported inheritance is used to buy the property versus the unpublished case in which it was clearly owned by the husband in that case, I believe, prior to marriage. What legal basis or factual and legal would you make to us of why that there is no distinction?
I would make no distinction because it still falls under the category of non-marital property. Whether you get the non-marital property before the marriage or during the marriage, you can still acquire non-marital property during the marriage. And Mrs. Keenholz was represented by an attorney during this proceeding. I assume there would have been discussions of how this property was acquired. Given the affirmative duty to disclose all assets and liabilities.
So what you're coming back to is that you are telling us that this petitioner had a duty to either allege in the petition for marriage dissolution or to tell the court, oh, by the way, the respondent, were he here, might try to satisfy his burden of proving a non-marital interest in the property.
Yes, I would point to the Bjorg case. That's the exact argument that the wife made in Bjorg, that it was abuse of discretion because essentially the district court wanted me to raise the husband's argument. And this court concluded it wasn't an abuse of discretion because it wasn't arguing the husband's point. It was making the full and accurate disclosure of assets. And that's exactly what we're arguing here today. You can't just ignore non-marital assets and not
But by definition, a default hearing is a summary proceeding. It would appear that if we adopted your reasoning, anytime, believe me, there's many, 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 as you know, default hearings. Every time there's a default hearing, my goodness, you'd have to go through everything in the cupboard in order to satisfy what you're saying was not satisfied here. Does that not put a burden on the court? A default means you didn't bother to hire an attorney, you didn't bother to file an answer.
Well, I don't think it necessarily would create so significant of a burden. I think in this case, it's particularly important given that this is essentially the most valuable asset.
But why didn't he secure? What I'm getting at is he was served with the summons and petition. Flash forward, yes, he's in prison, but there was a lot of time that transpired between then and where he was. In fact, your brief indicates his public defender even argued to try to hold him in the county jail for a couple of days so he could be there. He knows the hearing is coming up. Why isn't he doing anything?
And I can't speak for Mr. Keenholz on why he didn't do anything at that time.
But don't you have to show the court in order to survive your request? Don't you have to show some meaningful reason why he did not answer the due diligence part?
I don't think it's a tough stretch of the imagination for an individual that's incarcerated with no legal...
Before he was incarcerated.
I think it was shortly after he was served with the summons and petition that he was incarcerated.
He was able to have a public defender and defend himself on whatever legal criminal charges.
Well, that's the difference between the criminal case and the civil case. He gets a free attorney for that. He doesn't get a public defender appointed.
I think that somewhat disproves that he doesn't have any clue about what lawyers do and what they're all about. And obviously, he at least mentioned it to his public defender that he had a hearing because they made a request to hold him.
Sure.
He's not totally in the dark.
Right. And I mean, I think at least with pro se defendants, it's not entirely out of the realm of possibility that a formal answer is not filed and they show up at the default hearing based on the summons. In this case, it wasn't possible. He made the request.
I think I'd be more sympathetic to your client if there was a bigger offer of proof that he had some mental incompetency or that he was his alcoholism had led to his impairment that he couldn't understand, and I don't see that as a part of the record. Did you try to proffer that type of information to the judge?
Well, the only information related to the brain damage and alcoholism was at the initial default hearing from the respondent. Our position at the motion hearing was simply that his incarceration significantly curtailed his ability to...
Could you have... Well, I guess you didn't. It's not a part of the record. So what you're saying is that wife in this particular case happened to bring it up.
Yes, correct. And before I get finished, your time is running short, I did just want to bring up the issue of the division of the non-marital property. Judge Anderson indicated on the record that even if it is determined that the respondent would need to invade the non-marital property, they can only invade that up to half of the non-marital property. In this case, again, I think there is a sufficient tracing of the non-marital property, and more than half of that was awarded to the respondent. Just based on the statute, I think that's an abuse of discretion, not awarding non-marital property in accordance with the governing statute. So for all those reasons, I believe either the failure to identify the non-marital property and make a full and fair, accurate disclosure of that, the reasonable, excusable neglect by Mr. Keenholz, he did bring this motion within the one-year time period, and then additionally, the failure to divide the non-marital property according to statute, all provide basis for reversal and remand to the district court for further proceedings on distribution of the party's property. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Respondent, you may proceed.
Good morning. My name is Cynthia Vermolen. I represent the respondent, Denise Keenholz. This is a unique fact pattern in that the parties were married 47 years. They had lived in different homes throughout their marriage. They purchased the homestead that they owned at the time of the dissolution as their last or final marital homestead. It is noteworthy, and I note that it hasn't been referenced by counsel for the appellant, that the appellant, very soon after the purchase of that homestead, he obtained a mortgage on that homestead in the joint names of both parties, as has been referenced and cited in the respondent's brief.
I can't remember the principal balance of that originally. What was it?
At the time of dissolution, it was $149,000. That's now gone up by about $20,000. The obligation for payment of that mortgage in the dissolution decree is solely on the respondent.
Well, here's what bothers me about husband. I'm just going to call him husband because he was respondent and now he's appellant. The findings of fact, which obviously you submitted to the district court for signature, indicates respondent is self-represented. And a finding says respondent is self-represented. That makes it sound like he's kind of in the game. And then you need to make some accommodation or at least consider why he was not able to be present for that the default hearing. I mean, if he didn't file an answer, didn't pay a filing fee or get an informa pauperis, how can he be self-represented?
If I could just address that particular vernacular that was used. At a training, we were on family law, we were trained to, instead of using the word pro se, to use the term self-represented in our documents. And so I apologize if that misled the court. He was not involved. He did not respond to any of the communications. And this isn't a case where we went in on the 31st day and tried to get a dissolution finalized.
I don't know what training you went to, but I think they should change that vernacular, because if he hasn't filed an answer, he's not a party. He's...
Understand.
All right.
But he's, okay. But he's still part...
Thank you for explaining that. That's yes. Just your terminology that you used.
It was my terminology based on what I was instructed was the new acceptable terminology for a pro se individual.
Ms. Vermaelen, would it be safe to say that factually there's no dispute in terms of the source of the money, I believe it was his father's inheritance, was used to purchase this property?
Correct. We didn't dispute the documents that were prepared by appellant's counsel's firm back when that inheritance took place. And actually, that was at that time, that firm was representing both parties.
Wouldn't you agree then, at least that information under the full and fair disclosure language from Doering and that this court in Bjorn used, that on its face at least would already have reversed the presumption of non-marital, because if all the money used, and we agree all the money used, was his father's inheritance to him, would that not be at least at a minimum an obligation for your client at a default hearing simply to tell the court that?
Obviously, that argument is being made. I think I would cite to the Thompson decision, 2007 Court of Appeals decision cited here, that, quote, the financial information wife provided was based on the best information she had. There's no question that we did not present any evidence at the motion to reopen that disputed the accuracy or credibility of the paperwork showing that he did receive an inheritance. Similarly, wife received a substantial inheritance during the marriage. Respondent was not, did not specifically disclose, so to speak, that this was non-marital asset because she didn't believe it was non-marital. It was encumbered by a joint mortgage. She believed that it had been acquired with both of their inheritance funds and their marital funds.
Can I just clarify? So there is evidence in the record that it wasn't solely his inheritance that purchased that property, but she had inheritance too that purchased the property?
There's evidence in the record on the motion to reopen that she had also, she had received, I think she had said originally at the time of the dissolution, she had indicated it was something like $130,000, but then at the time of motion to reopen, she had gone through records and it turned out to be about $200,000.
But that was a separate...
That was a separate, separate inheritance, separate dates.
Okay.
But those funds were also funneled through the marital estate.
The question I'm getting at is how, and I realize Bjorg is an unpublished decision that's interpreting following Doering, but which references a lesser standard and does not obligate your client to misrepresent, but simply to inform the court. How would that, as a matter of law, distinguish the Bjorg case where the property was owned by the husband before marriage versus here all the money's from his inheritance to buy that property? Wouldn't that equally obligate her to at least inform the court of that? The court can still decide to do what it maybe did, arguably, but it would be a different... we'd be in a different procedural situation if the court was informed.
Understand, Your Honor. And again, the Bjork case is distinguishable because it involved a 7-year marriage, not a 47-year marriage. And it involved the husband owning this property well in advance of marriage. So it was, there was no mistake about the fact that it was non-marital. And it also involved findings that the wife had concealed the husband's ownership. So in that particular, again, unpublished case in which appellant's counsel actually was involved, representing one of the parties, that's how that occurred. The Doering case has the only similarity in particular is that it was a 25-year marriage. So it was, again, a longer marriage than the Bjork case. But it involved intent. It involved divorce planning. It was a case involving child custody, child support, and there was a signed marital termination agreement. Again, very distinguishable from the present facts of this particular case, in which personal service was completed November 6, 2016 on the appellant at the homestead of the parties. The default hearing was not held until April 28, 2017. That is a very lengthy period of time in which the appellant had to assert his interests. And contrary to what counsel for appellant assumes, based on his argument here, counsel at the motion to reopen similarly wasn't aware, but the record reflects, and the district court was aware, that appellant was incarcerated on and off for periods of time after his personal service. He wasn't continuously incarcerated that entire time. Also, he was not in prison, incarcerated in a prison setting, until April 27th, 2017, when he was transported. Prior to that, he had been in county jail, and as has been stated in the pleadings and in the transcript of the motion to reopen, as a criminal defense lawyer, I am also well aware that in Morrison County Jail, access to a lawyer, access to the phones is freely provided. And I could call that jail and talk to an inmate like in about 5 minutes, which is highly different than most jails. So there was no evidence presented to dispute that whatsoever. Here, even if Ms. Keenholz had a duty to disclose the non-marital contributions by the appellant, this court has a job of reviewing the district court's decision denying that motion to reopen. And this court's duty is to affirm that decision unless it finds that the district court abused its discretion and made a clearly erroneous decision. And in this case, the district court found that the appellant had not met its standard for burden of proof by preponderance of evidence as far as the grounds for the motion to reopen under Minnesota Statute 518.45.
Ms. Vermaelen, on that point, I noticed the court in particular used the word fraud on the court. Would you agree that that's not the standard this court or that court should have applied under the Doering and previous cases, but a lesser standard of fraud?
I would agree, Your Honor, that ordinary fraud, as defined in the Doering case and others, would be applicable, and that may have been an error on the part of the court. However, we would submit that it's harmless error. It didn't affect the substance of the court's decision, and that this court should look to the Knapp case in which it affirmed, these are published decisions, in which it affirmed the denial of the motion to reopen. Again, a 39-year marriage. There was chemical dependency and mental health issues in the appellant, and the district court found that he simply failed to meet his burden of proof. Similarly, in the Kornberg case, the Supreme Court 1996 decision with a 34-year marriage, there was a bundle of different issues in that particular case. One of them did relate to the failure to meet the burden of proof in the showing of for the motion to reopen, but that case also involved two different countries, and it was a rather complex case. And similarly, the Thompson case, decision by this court in 2007, a two-year marriage, but in this case there was the husband was incarcerated related to alcohol offenses. And again, the court found there was the evidence did not meet the burden of proof and affirmed the denial of the motion by the husband. So we would ask that this court consider the unique facts of this case, the record as it exists, and with, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention here something that wasn't mentioned by appellant either in his motion to reopen or in his brief or in his argument before this court, that the appellant filed an appeal before this one. He filed that appeal September 8th, 2017, which demonstrated his awareness of the legal system, awareness of this case, access to resources. That case, as referenced in the respondent's brief, demonstrates that he really pulls the rug out from under his allegations that he lacks access to resources while incarcerated. This court dismissed that appeal on October 3rd because of the appellant's failure to comply with the September 12th, 2017 order that it issued, basically asking him to address issues of jurisdiction and so on. But to me, you know, it's significant to this court that appellant himself has not even acknowledged that appeal, and the issue is how does that factor into then he waited several months later until April, I believe, 25th, 2018, some 3 days before the end of the one-year period to file his motion to reopen. So we submit that the district court's findings that there was proper notice and access to legal resources and that any error that this court or that the district court may have made in listing the standard of fraud on the court versus ordinary fraud was harmless error and does not dictate a finding that there was a clearly erroneous decision. The district court stated very specific reasons for its decision. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Appellant, you may respond if you wish.
Thank you. Just as a brief response, I believe one of the issues that opposing counsel mentioned is that the standard for disclosing information or assets for a party should be the information that's available to the parties. I would submit that such information in this case would have been available to Ms. Keenholz. Ostensibly, she knew how the purchase of the home was funded. It's a significant check in the amount of $311,000. Given the fact that this matter proceeded through a default with Ms. Keenholz knowing that Mr. Keenholz wanted to appear, not wanting to make any arrangements for him to appear by telephone or otherwise accommodate him, I think that raises concerns related to not only the disclosure of assets, but also the fairness and reasonable neglect. I would note that Judge Anderson's order, I don't believe, really issued any significant findings related to the excusable neglect prong that was alleged in the motion. I believe it was more just a conclusory statement that any motion to reopen would be under the fraud standard. So it's difficult for the appellant to make arguments about any clearly erroneous findings related to the excusable neglect, given the absence of any such findings.
Counsel, I just want to return to the allegation that you're making with respect to ordinary fraud. I see in the notice of motion and motion, and then actually in your client's memorandum of law in support of the motion on page 6, you argued to the district court that respondent's affidavit, that petitioner indicated that the residence consisted entirely of marital property. And you don't say where. the petitioner indicated that. It's on page 6 of the memorandum of law.
Okay.
Is that someplace other than in the original petition for marriage dissolution?
I think the reference to that was, again, I believe we kind of discussed it earlier, related to the fact that since there was no representation that it was any non-marital interest, that the representation essentially was that it was marital.
Okay, but there isn't something in the record that I'm missing where the petitioner actually told the court this is marital, that actually said to the court the respondent does not possibly have a non-marital claim in any property.
No, not to my knowledge, and that's not the argument we're making. I'm sorry if that was confusion on our part in drafting it, but our argument has always been that it was the non-disclosure of the non-marital interest that is really at issue in this case, which essentially...
Okay, because you did say in the memorandum of law to the district court that her representation did not accurately reflect the characterization of the residence, and I don't see anything in the petition that says marital or non-marital.
I think it's fair to say that it doesn't accurately reflect the characterization of it if it doesn't identify the non-marital interest. That would be our point.
So she should have made an admission in the petition or conceded a non-marital interest?
I don't think it's a concession. I would say it's an accurate disclosure of the party's assets in this case.
Okay. I need to say one thing, and I just can't shut up, and I'll kick myself afterwards. But, you know, I can't help but thinking about all these allegations of fraud and what's been disclosed, and I keep thinking about him having his public defender. And I'm just wondering what the disclosures were on his application for a public defender in which he indicated he had nothing so that he would qualify, and where all of that sat in connection with where we're at now. That does not even ask for an answer, but I just had to say it.
I appreciate that. And as I'm just finishing up here, I would just again raise the issue about the division of marital property up to the 50% level. It was apparently, I believe, conceded that the non-marital inheritance funds were used to purchase the property. There was no discussion, as far as I can recall,